following is tape 3 of an interview with Judge Betty Roberts. The interview is being conducted at Judge Roberts' home at 319 Southeast Gillam in Portland. The date is November 14, 1980, and the interviewer is Linda Brody for the Oregon Historical Society. Now, Judge Roberts, we were talking about your experience in the Senate and women's issues. Were there other issues when you were in the Senate that you would like to comment on?
Sorry. There were a lot of issues, of course, that I became involved in the Senate, and I think maybe one way to talk about that is to talk about it from the standpoint of the committees that I worked on. I was on the Education Committee again when I first went to the Senate, and there again I tried the kindergarten, so I think this is sort of an unusual situation, so I'll relate it quickly. I had come to the conclusion after teaching seniors in high school for a number of years that many of the seniors simply did not put in a full day at school. They were off on work programs. They were after the semester, they were beginning to think about graduation, and you know, there just wasn't a lot achieved in the senior year. A lot was achieved, but not that much, I thought. And so I decided that perhaps, again, a way to get kindergartens would be to reduce the age that a child starts school by 1 year, and to reduce the age of compulsory school attendance by 1 year at the top end. And I convinced the three members of our education committee, a majority of our education committee, that that was a good proposal. They voted out the bill, and it went down to the floor of the Senate. And on a Friday, we debated it, and it carried by one vote. And I was absolutely elated now that this is one way now we're going to start kids to school 1 year earlier. But someone who had voted against it gave notice of a possible reconsideration on Monday. And when I went on the floor of the Senate on Monday, senator after senator came up to me and said, "Betty, I voted with you on Friday, but I just can't do it today. I talked to my superintendent over the weekend." I didn't know that's what that bill did. And so there were my attempt to get some little kids in school a little earlier failed. But that was an interesting experiment. And every once in a while, legislators, you know, will think, "I've got a unique way to do this." But invariably, someone always finds out. I was chairman of the Consumer and Business Affairs Committee for a number of sessions, and in that position, we worked on issues dealing with regulatory agencies that license persons in the state of Oregon, such as the CPAs, the architects, the beauticians, the barbers, and so on. So we were dealing with a great deal of legislation involving those kinds of business activities. We also received a lot of consumer legislation, and some of the consumer protection proposals went through that committee. We had landlord-tenant legislation there. It was really a very, very wide range of bills that were assigned to our committee, and so we had an opportunity to work with a lot of different kinds of people. I also was on the Senate Judiciary Committee for two sessions. The last two sessions I was there, and I was vice chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I of course was. And it was the first time I'd served on the Judiciary Committee after becoming a lawyer, and so I was really impressed with the kind of work there. Not impressed with it, but I was eager to work with that legislation because of my profession. And I think that experience on the Judiciary may have been what encouraged me to take a position on the bench. I also was on Ways and Means Committee a number of sessions. I served as vice chairman for one session, and of course, and that is an extremely hard-working committee because all of the budgets go through Ways and Means.
How did you decide which which things to fund while you were on the Ways and Means?
Well, sometimes what you fund is a matter of how much money you have to work with, because there are certain programs that have to continue. Obviously, the school funding has a certain amount already identified that for higher education, highways, and so on. But after the fundamentals of government are provided for, then of course it's a matter of interest and what you can convince your other members of Ways and Means should be funded. My inclination carried along with my other interests, such as adequate school finance, and in both public education and higher education, daycare, which I worked very hard to secure. I think in the 73 session, our first time to actually set aside state money for daycare, and that was a very important step in at least initiating the program and saying that state government has undertaken to do this and it's a policy matter thereafter, or to establish the policy and then it's a funding matter thereafter. I, of course, continued to try to get funding for the criminal injuries compensation because I was then in the position to actually evaluate whether or not there was money available and whether or not we could finance that kind of a program. But I think generally I was just concerned about funding agencies adequately for the activity that they're to do. And then when some new program came along, it was a matter of a value judgment on whether or not the money should be spent in that program or in another program. And there's always more demands than there's money to go around. And sometimes we had to say no to some very worthwhile projects and simply pick and choose what we could do. Or not give the requested money, but decrease the amount of money, hope that they can work with that and thereby spread it out a bit. Ways and Means was a very important experience to me. It was important to work with the fiscal staff, the fiscal office staff, the people who made recommendations to us after they had analyzed the budget proposals. Very professional people, very capable people. It was interesting to work with the agencies who brought the budgets to us and to learn about the internal operation of the state. From the standpoint of learning about state government, the Ways and Means Committee is really the place to do it because you go through every agency's budget, you know about every program that they're financing, you have an opportunity to ask some questions about how the program's working, why they're not doing this and why they're doing something else, and to learn about their responsibilities and how they're performing those responsibilities. So I thought, you know, and people call the Ways and Means Committee the, quote, powerful committee. Well, it really is that. Because that committee can influence, either by its funding or not funding, certain kinds of programs, or it can compel agencies to do certain things. So it does have a great deal of power over state government. I think probably that I made my best contributions there in the sense that I was I think able to influence some decisions that were made there. Another area that I worked in was in a program for senior citizens. I had been chairman of an interim committee that had designated as one of its problems to study were problems of the aging. And that was in the interim between the 71 and 73 session. And so all during that interim, we were working a lot of things on juvenile problems, on domestic relations, senior citizens' health problems, generally. And during that interim that we would only be able to just scratch the surface of problems with aging, but it was the first time it had been addressed in the Oregon legislature as a subject matter to be studied by a committee. My administrative assistant learned that there was federal money available for legislatures who were interested in pursuing problems of senior citizens. we made an application for a grant. We were awarded a grant, and of course this went through the president's office and so on, the leadership in the Senate. And it was decided that we would have a continuing, we would have a committee that would be established in the legislature while the legislature was meeting on aging. And I became chairman of that committee. And as a result of being on that committee, and then of course most of those programs needing funding, and then as a member of Ways and Means, I was able then to communicate the concerns of the types of program, such as programs like Meals on Wheels and supplement for heating expenses, nursing home expenses, medical expenses, all sorts of things, transportation for the elderly, that we were beginning to realize were multiple problems of senior citizens. And so from that standpoint, I could transfer the information we were getting in the committee, and then where we needed some funding, I could sponsor that and support it in the Ways and Means Committee. So my experience in the other committees, you know, invariably led to an understanding and already a predisposed position for what was going to happen in Ways and Means on those particular programs. I think, Linda, one not on some of the issues in my work in the legislature, but it would be a serious omission if we didn't talk about the what was called the coalition of the Senate, which when I went to the legislature in 69 was in full force and had been since about the middle 50s when the, I think it was 55 session, before my time, but I think that's accurate, when there was an equal number of Democrats and equal number of Republicans in the Senate. And for about 3 weeks, they were unable to organize because they couldn't select a president of the Senate from one party or the other. And finally, a compromise was entered into, and after that period of time, the number of Republicans dwindled and the number of Democrats increased, but for a number of sessions, the Republicans and just a handful of Democrats, it usually varied from 5 to 7, were able to control the Senate. So while you had a majority of Democrats who should have together decided who was going to be president of the Senate, you had enough Democrats leave the Democratic caucus and vote with the Republicans to control the Senate. So for a period of about 10 to 12, about 14 years, that coalition controlled the Senate. And during that 14 years, which would have been about 7 sessions, the president of the Senate was sort of passed around among those Democrats, and they sort of each took turns being president of the Senate. Senator Boyven from Klamath Falls, for example, was president for a couple of terms. Senator Potts, who was president when I went there in 69, was president for a couple of terms. Then in 1971, we had decided that we were going to attempt to break the coalition, the Democrats were, and that we were going to hold together. And by that time, Senator Potts had said he'd stay with the regular Democrats. And I must tell you also that Senator Tom Mahoney was reelected to the Senate in 1970. So in 1971, he came back to the Senate. But one of the things that I had campaigned on against Senator Mahoney was that he was a member of the coalition and that I would not be. That I would not team up with the Republicans, that I would work with the Democrats to elect a Democrat selected by the Democrats for president of the Senate. So when Tom Mahoney came back to the Senate in 71, he'd seen the light, and he had decided that he would join with the Democrats, and that that together in the caucus that we would elect a Democrat. So we had, unusually, we had 15 the Republicans had begun to, again, recoup their numbers. And so in the Senate in 71, we had 15 Republicans and 15 Democrats. So we had a deadlock then. And after 2 weeks of trying to talk with the Republicans and decide who should be president of the Senate, one of our members, who was John Burns, came in on the second Friday that we were there, the last day of the second week, and said that he was going to break the deadlock and that he was going to be the president of the Senate, and the Republicans had all agreed to vote for him. And so he did that, and he became president of the Senate. John Burns did not choose to run for re-election after that year, and has not served in the Senate since. But he, and it was a very difficult session for Senator Burns. John and I have remained friends, and I worked with him all right in that session. But there was a lot of bitterness, as you can imagine, generated as a result of that. And then in the next session, Senator Jason Bow was elected by the regular Democratic caucus, and Senator Bow had the outstanding and unusual, set an outstanding, unusual precedent by then serving four terms as president of the Senate. So Senator, I then served from 73 on with President Bow as, with Senator Bow as the president of the Senate. But I think breaking that coalition after that period of time was an important event for me, and it was an important event, you know, for the people of the state to really go back to the two-party system in the legislative process, because before that time it was very difficult for anybody to know who was calling the shots, who was really in power, you know, who was making the decisions. And it was difficult in an election to either praise or blame Democrats or Republicans, because you just didn't know what was happening. But that was historically very important. I think there was one other significant event that happened in 71 when John Burns was president, and that was the 18-year-old, the ratification of the amendment to the federal constitution allowing 18-year-olds to vote. Some of us had proposed legislation before that ratification of that amendment to allow 18-year-olds to vote in the state of Oregon. But there was a great deal of opposition to ratifying that proposal. It seems kind of strange in Oregon because we've sort of been a leader in those kinds of issues. But at any rate, the President of the Senate was just determined that he was not going to, John Burns, that he was not going to allow that bill to come out of the Elections Committee. And the Elections Committee was deadlocked on it, and it had not been voted out. But during that session, we still had the old, we're still operating under the old law where when the governor is out of the state, the president becomes the governor. And so the governor was out of the state, President John Burns went into the governor's office to assume some responsibilities there, and while he was gone, Harry Boivin, who was president pro tem, became the president of the Senate. And so Senator Boivin simply appointed himself to the Elections Committee. He went up to the elections meeting. He then made a majority vote to vote out the 18-year-old ratification proposal. And it then was before the Senate. Well, immediately word was all over the Capitol of what happened, and Senator Burns attempted to stop the reporting of that bill to the floor, and that was overcome by some parliamentary procedures that it had in fact been reported out. It was then accomplished that it was at before the Senate and that he could do nothing about it. Then the next stall was to prevent it from getting on the floor and for us to debate it. So it was held up for a few days. Finally, the Democrats decided that we could play games too, and that if the president was not going to allow that bill to be debated and voted on the floor, that we would not provide a quorum for the Senate so that nothing could happen. You have to have a quorum before you can do any business. So one day we simply did not report for roll call. One or two did in order to keep us informed. We simply went into our Senate caucus room and just stayed, waited, read, talked, you know, did anything, played a little poker eventually when it got kind of boring. The president, President Burns, did everything possible to try to convince us, you know, we should come up and make a quorum so the business of the Senate could continue, and we refused to do so. We ultimately had word that the President Senate was sending the state police for us, and that the state police would be arriving very shortly, and that the state police would compel our attendance, which the President has power to do, you know, if he can do it. When we got that word, we'd already anticipated that. We had planned that we would simply leave the Capitol and we'd go to various places, separate, go to various places, and just wait, be in telephone contact. And when the President decided to give in and say, all right, you can have the 18-year-old vote to debate, we'd go back and we'd make a quorum. And so we did leave the Capitol, and I went with Boivin, Harry Boivin, and Jason Bowe, just coincidentally, because we all walked out the door together, to an apartment of our clerk, whose husband was there, knew it was going to happen. Then we had word that, we went to Harry Boivin's apartment, which was near the Capitol building, and then when we got word by telephone that the police were looking, in fact, state police were in fact following the President's orders and looking for us, and that they probably would look close to the Capitol first, we left Senator Boivin's apartment and went to the home of the woman clerk of the Senate caucus. And there we stayed until we had a telephone call saying that the President had given in. And
how long was that?
Oh, that was probably from the time we started in the morning until we got word. It was past lunchtime, so we were into afternoon sometime. And this had gone on, you know, since 8 or 9 o'clock that morning. That was an unusual experience in the legislature. And I guess it just shows you, you know, to what extreme a group can go, or a party can go, or anybody can go, to thwart the president, presiding officer, or to the extent you can use the parliamentary rules to gain an objective or to gain an advantage. And it was kind of fighting fire with fire, you know. We didn't think the president had a right to hold up that bill, because it had all happened purely legally. He didn't expect Harry Boivin to appoint himself to the Elections Committee, but he did. And he did it, you know, following the rules. And so if the President wasn't going to follow the rules and let us vote on the 18-year-old vote ratification, we simply wouldn't give him a quorum. And we had to go to some extremes to do it. But then it was voted on and it was passed.
Did the Democrats all support the bill, or was it just the point of having it on the floor?
I think most all the Democrats were supporting it, as I recall. I'm not sure that John Burns was not supporting it himself, but, you know, for whatever reasons, he apparently had made commitments on it. As I recall, I think all the Democrats were supporting it. But if there were any Democrats who were not supporting the bill, they were willing to support the caucus because of just the parliamentary procedure that we needed to compel a president to do what he was obligated to do. And that was to report the bill out, let us debate it, and let us vote on it. So that was a unique experience, which doesn't happen every session. But the breaking up, the fact that we didn't quite break the coalition, we really did in 71, even though John Burns became President of the Senate, and he did appoint a number of Republicans as chairman of committees, he had to appoint a number of Democrats as chairman of committees also. And so, you know, it was, in a sense, was the breakthrough for the coalition, and it prepared the way then for the next session, because it was kind of a traumatic experience, and no one wanted that to happen again, really. The Republicans didn't want it, and the Democrats didn't want it either. So since then, you know, it's been a straight party decision of who will be president of the Senate.
It's an amazing story.
Yeah, it is. It's really, really fascinating. I think I ought to tell you, I guess because we're getting sort of toward the end of this, about my political year in 74, because that was a very unique and unusual political year. It has nothing to do with the legislature, except that I was a well-known political figure and had good support from a lot of areas. And I just, in the fall of 73, began thinking about it during the legislature of 73, that I'd run for governor in 74, because it was Tom McCall's term had ended, and though Bob Straub seemed to be the person who most likely would be running, it didn't necessarily mean that he could get elected. And so I began to, and there did not appear to be any really outstanding Republicans at that time who were going to, who would be extremely difficult to, such as Tom McCall, to overcome their popularity. So I decided to start thinking about running for governor, and did, and announced in late October of 73 that I intended to, and started putting together a campaign. It was an excellent campaign. It was very, very well run, well organized, good people running the campaign, and we in the primary, Bob Straub beat me by about 8,000 votes. And Jim Redden was also in that campaign. So it was a three-way vote, but Bob was first and I was second, and Jim was third, considerably down, which I think surprised an awful lot of people that that I had that kind of voting support and could draw that kind of vote. I was disappointed, of course, because I had really gone into it very seriously and had thought that I could beat Bob. The but I didn't. Then in July of that year, Senator Wayne Morse, who had gotten the nomination for the U.S. Senate, Bob Packwood had beaten Senator Morse 6 years before, and Packwood was up for re-election. So Senator Morse had decided that he would attempt to unseat Packwood and reverse what had happened the 6 years previously. So Senator Morse had that nomination, but he unfortunately died in July of that summer. There, of course, was an immediate responsibility on the part of the state Democratic Party to select a person to go on the ballot in the fall. There was a great deal of competition. Senator Boe, who had also been a Democratic nominee against Senator Morse, wanted to be named. Joe Smith, who had been defeated for Attorney General, wanted to I'm not sure in 74, I think a couple of years before that, had wanted to be named. And but I began to talk with some of my people, supporters, primarily the Democratic Party around the state, about the possibility of picking up the campaign where we'd left off, putting it together for the U.S. Senate. And a lot of people thought we could do it, that that we could, that we hadn't disbanded that much, and there were still a lot of people we could call on. And so I started then talking with the party people who would actually be voting, and they did select me to be the nominee. So, and that was at a state central committee meeting out in Baker. And that was in August. Immediately after that, of course, I had to pull my campaign back together, and I'd lost a few people because Bob Straub, then, who was the nominee for governor and who ran against Vic Atiyah, had picked up a lot of my people, my key people, to work in his campaign. But we did the best we could, and Bob Packwood beat me by only 5% of the votes, and that was a very tough campaign because I was switching gears from the governor's race into a national race, which meant I really had to do some quick work on issues, do a lot of research on Packwood's his record in the U.S. Senate. And, you know, it just took on a whole different approach to campaigning, and campaigns do. If you're running for one office, you campaign one way. If you're running for another office, you campaign a different way. You know, the basics are there, but a lot of things, the issues are different.
How did you relate to the National Democratic Party?
Well, I went immediately back to Washington, D.C., and I went to the National Democratic, made an appearance before them, seeking money, talking with them about the issues and the possibility, what potential I had. I went to the Senate Democratic Committee looking for money. I went to a lot of the groups, a lot of the lobbying groups, the political action groups in Washington, D.C., and that was where I got most of my money. But, you know, that was new and different to me. I really had not had those contacts, and it was, but I had to do it, and I did it in a hurry, and then I had to get prepared for a campaign. I still think given all the time I had on the governor's race, and if I'd been on the Senate race, that I would have beaten Packwood. But, you know, there was no way I was going to get in Democratic primary against Senator Morris, who I loved dearly and respected. And so it was coincidence that I was involved in that race at all, but did at least make a good showing for the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, didn't win.
Did you have, we'll start on the other side.